All right, we've come to chapter 2 of Esther, but I want to read, to begin with, from Revelation chapter 12. There is a point to that, but let me remind you that last week, as we introduced the book, I made the point that the main point of the story of the book of Esther is that God preserves His church, the Old Testament church, the Jews, especially preserves the line of the Messiah from the attempts to destroy them. In that case, they're embodied in one person, Haman. But that larger picture then of the coming of the Messiah and the attempts of Satan to destroy the seed of the woman may seem a little bit distant for us because the Messiah has come, but I want us to see it as part of a larger picture of the continued preservation of the church. Excuse me. For that reason, I want to read Revelation chapter 12, which is about as long as the part of Esther we're going to cover, but I think it'll be helpful. Now a great sign appeared in heaven, a woman clothed with the sun, with the moon under her feet, and on her head a garland of 12 stars. Then being with child, she cried out in labor and in pain to give birth. And another sign appeared in heaven. Behold, a great fiery red dragon having 7 heads and 10 horns and 7 diadems on his heads. His tail drew a third of the stars of heaven and threw them to the earth. And the dragon stood before the woman who was ready to give birth to devour her child as soon as it was born. She bore a male child who was to rule all nations with a rod of iron. And her child was caught up to God and his throne. Then the woman fled into the wilderness, where she has a place prepared by God, that they should feed her there 1,260 days. And war broke out in heaven. Michael and his angels fought with the dragon, and the dragon and his angels fought, but they did not prevail, nor was a place found for them in heaven any longer. So the great dragon was cast out, that serpent of old, called the devil and Satan, who deceives the whole world. He was cast to the earth, and his angels were cast out with him. Then I heard a loud voice saying in heaven, Now salvation and strength and the kingdom of our God and the power of his Christ have come. For the accuser of our brethren who accused them before our God day and night has been cast down. And they overcame him by the blood of the Lamb and by the word of their testimony, and they did not love their lives to the death. Therefore rejoice, O heavens, and you who dwell in them. Woe to the inhabitants of the earth and the sea. For the devil has come down to you, having great wrath, because he knows that he has a short time. Now when the dragon saw that he had been cast to the earth, he persecuted the woman who gave birth to the male child. But the woman was given 2 wings of a great eagle, that she might fly into the wilderness to her place, where she is nourished for a time and times and half a time from the presence of the serpent. So the serpent spewed water out of his mouth like a flood after the woman, that he might cause her to be carried away by the flood. But the earth helped the woman, and the earth opened its mouth and swallowed up the flood which the dragon had spewed out of his mouth. And the dragon was enraged with the woman, and he went to make war with the rest of her offspring, who keep the commandments of God and have the testimony of Jesus Christ. Now, especially in verse 4, you see the antagonism of the dragon, who's identified explicitly as Satan, toward the child who would be born. And this attempt to destroy, to devour the child is, of course, frustrated by God, and the child is born as the Son of God, and the chapter goes on past that point. But it's instructive to reflect on the whole history of God's dealings that are, in some sense, encapsulated in that one verse, in verse 4. If you look at William Hendrickson's commentary on Revelation, he has a brief survey of the Old Testament really packed into his commentary on verse 4. It's otherwise a very brief commentary on the book of Revelation. But he surveys how, again and again in the Old Testament, Satan was seeking to destroy the line, the seed of the woman, the line of the Messiah. And I won't go through all of that. I put some references on the board, but I mentioned last week the original promise that the seed of the woman would crush the head of the serpent, although the serpent would be seeking to strike the seed of the woman. And we looked at Genesis 12 and the Abrahamic covenant, the promise that in Abraham's seed all the nations would be blessed, which implies the continuation of Abraham's seed until at least the coming of the Messiah. And again in the Old Testament you can see this threat. One of my favorite in terms of dramatic powers in 2 Kings 11:1. I think we won't look there, but remember Athaliah had come to power illegitimately as a queen, or at least an effective ruler. And the first thing she did was to destroy all the royal seed. And that's what 2 Kings 11:1 says. When she came to power, she destroyed all of the royal seed. Okay. Now, if you just read that verse, you think it's all over, because David's descendant was to be the Messiah. The Messiah was supposed to come from David. And so finally, at last, in the person of Athaliah, the dragon has indeed frustrated the plans of God. But then you read verse 2 and it says, but the nurse hid away this one descendant of David who ultimately was put on the throne by a rather interesting set of circumstances. So, but you could read through all of the Old Testament. Hendrickson mentioned specifically the book of Esther in his description of how again and again Satan was seeking to frustrate the plan of God. And that's important for us as well, because Revelation 12 doesn't stop there with the birth of the child, right? The serpent who is defeated, that's a very important thing to keep in mind, defeated, cast out of heaven, is still seeking to persecute the church. And again, he's frustrated in his persecution. The woman is protected. The church, even in spite of the persecution that Satan seeks to bring against the church, is protected by God. So I want you to see that continuity, which is very clear in Revelation 12, because otherwise the book of Esther is about an Old Testament Holocaust in the sense that the Nazis attempted a Holocaust. It's about God frustrating something that had to do with some race some long time ago, which was very bad. We don't believe in ethnic cleansing, but except for people who are under the ban in the destruction of the under Joshua. But that story could seem distant from us unless we realize that it was our family story. We're not Jews ethnically, but it's our story that's being told in the book of Esther. Satan is still trying to destroy the church in our own day. And that's the point that Paul makes at least a couple of times. And again, we won't look at the references, Romans 15 and 1 Corinthians 10. He says, you know, I'm telling you these things, and I'm quoting from the Old Testament, but these are our fathers, and these things are written for us. They weren't just interesting stories for us to repeat. They're our stories, and they have to do with our salvation. And that's a very important point for us to keep in mind. The Westminster Confession of Faith, in theological terms, makes the same point. This is chapter 25, the section 4. It says, there shall be always a church on earth to worship God according to his will. In theological terms, this is or has been called the perpetuity of the church. It's the promise of God that he will preserve a pure remnant to worship him. One of the scripture references is Matthew 16:18. The gates of hell shall not prevail against the church. So if you like, the story in Esther is really the same as the story that believers experience in China or in Sri Lanka or all over the world, where Satan seeks to stamp out a witness for his name. In a sense, it's more significant in Esther because the Messiah was yet to come. But it's still the long war of the seed of the serpent against the seed of the woman. And God has promised that he will preserve a witness for his name. So we should read Esther not with that sense of distance, but realizing that this is about God's power, which is still at work among us. Okay, so that was a long introduction, but I wanted to expand on the point from last week, lest we think this is just a curious story about people with some morally ambiguous choices made. Any comments or questions so far? Okay, well then, let's go back to Esther chapter 2, which is what we're studying. I'm certainly not prepared to answer any questions on Revelation 12, so I'm glad you didn't ask any. Esther 2 starts with the phrase, after these things. So you'll remember that last week we saw that Queen Vashti had displeased the king. The king put her away and made some attempt to instruct the inhabitants of his empire on how husbands should be respected by their wives. I made the point last time that it's a rather clumsy attempt, but anyway, Esther 2 begins, after these things. After these things, when the wrath of King Ahasuerus subsided, he remembered Vashti, what she had done, and what had been decreed against her. Then the king's servants who attended him said, let beautiful young virgins be sought for the king, and let the king appoint officers in all the provinces of his kingdom, that they may gather all the beautiful young virgins to Shushan the citadel, into the women's quarters, under the custody of Hegai, the king's eunuch, custodian of the women, and let beauty preparations be given them. And then let the young woman who pleases the king be queen instead of Vashti. Excuse me. This thing pleased the king, and he did so. In Shushan the citadel, there was a certain Jew whose name was Mordecai, the son of Jair, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish, a Benjamite. Kish had been carried away from Jerusalem with the captives who had been captured with Jeconiah, king of Judah, whom Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, had carried away. And Mordecai had brought up Hadassah, that is, Esther, his uncle's daughter, for she had neither father nor mother. The young woman was lovely and beautiful. When her father and mother died, Mordecai took her as his own daughter. So it was when the king's command and decree were heard that, and when many young women were gathered at Shushan, the citadel, under the custody of Hegai, that Esther also was taken to the king's palace, in the care of Hegai, the custodian of the women. Now the young woman pleased him, and she obtained his favor, so he readily gave beauty preparations to her, besides her allowance. Then 7 choice maidservants were provided for her from the king's palace, and he moved her and her maidservants to the best place in the house of the women. Esther had not revealed her people or family, for Mordecai had charged her not to reveal it. And every day Mordecai paced in front of the court of the women's quarters to learn of Esther's welfare and what was happening to her. Each young woman's turn came to go in to King Ahasuerus after she had completed 12 months' preparation, according to the regulations for the women, for thus were the days of their preparation apportioned, 6 months with oil of myrrh, 6 months with perfumes and preparations for beautifying women. Thus prepared, each young woman went to the king, and she was given whatever she desired to take with her from the women's quarters to the king's palace. In the evening she went, and in the morning she returned to the second house of the women, to the custody of Shashgaz, the king's eunuch who kept the concubines. She would not go in to the king again unless the king delighted in her and called for her by name. Now when the turn came for Esther, the daughter of Abihail, the uncle of Mordecai, who had taken her as his daughter, to go in to the king, she requested nothing but what Hegai, the king's eunuch, the custodian of the women, advised. And Esther obtained favor in the sight of all who saw her. So Esther was taken to King Ahasuerus and to his royal palace in the 10th month, which is the month of Tebeth, in the 7th year of his reign. The king loved Esther more than all the other women, and she obtained grace and favor in his sight more than all the virgins. So he set the royal crown upon her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. Then the king made a great feast, the feast of Esther, for all his officials and servants, and he proclaimed a holiday in the provinces and gave gifts according to the generosity of a king. I think I actually stopped there. I'm probably not going to make it through that last bit today anyway. So this story tells how Esther came to be queen. She is queen instead of Vashti. Vashti was put away, as we saw in chapter 1. And I suppose the first thing that comes to a Christian's mind in reading this account is, how could Esther get in a situation like that? Or as one commentator said, you know, what is a good Jewish girl like you doing? You can fill in the rest of it. I made the point last time that that's really not the right question to ask. Okay, there are good questions and there are bad questions, and That one's a sort of in-between question. I will try to come back to it at the end. But it is important for us not to be deflected from the main point of the author's account. He is telling us how God delivered his people from an attempted Holocaust. Okay? And he does it by means of Esther. And Esther's place is queen. And he's really telling us how she came to be in that position. Now, I do want to make some comments on the text itself. And as I said, I hope to come back to some of the sort of moral ambiguities involved. But I'm certainly not going to answer all of the questions that might come up there. So first, let me just note, when it says after these things, there's not a definite time reference. But if you noticed toward the end of the passage I read, it said that Esther was made queen in the seventh year of the rule of Ahasuerus. Or she was taken to Ahasuerus. Presumably that's when she was crowned. But if you go back to the beginning of chapter 1, you see that it was in the third year of his reign that he made a feast. Now, it took some time for this whole process to go on. In fact, especially the females among us might be amazed at the 12 months preparation that were involved in this. So it took a while, but still, the king had been without Vashti for a long time, at least three years or so. He had been without Vashti. Now, if in fact this is King Xerxes, okay, so I made that identification last week with the reigns of the Persian monarchs or emperors, and I hope I made it clear last week that's not a definite thing. There have been a couple of different correspondences that have been proposed, actually more than a couple. But if in fact it was Xerxes, then in between, Xerxes was busy trying to conquer Greece, and he lost. Okay, he was defeated, humiliated, just as his father had been, and he came back. And I mentioned last week Herodotus, who is the famous Greek historian, roughly contemporaneous with Xerxes. He says that after Xerxes returned, and this is what Herodotus says, he lived in sensual indulgence afterwards. Okay, now that would be at least consistent with what we read here. It would probably also be consistent with most of the emperors who were around. But that there are indications of Xerxes' character in Herodotus' writings that are actually quite consistent with what we see in the Book of Esther. In any case, it's been some time. Regardless of what the guy was doing in between, it's been some time since Vashti was deposed. And it says in verse 1, he remembered and what had been decreed against her. And he is given a suggestion by his servants. And the servants propose, we might kindly call it a beauty contest, but actually this was not a beauty contest. Young virgins were to be sought for the king. It's pretty clear that they didn't have any choice in the matter. Okay, so they came to a community. Presumably they found out who the beautiful women in the community. They knocked on the door and said, "You're coming with me to the capital." That's probably the way it went. And I'll again come back to that. That has something to do with the moral choices that Esther and Mordecai make, probably. In any case, these women are to be brought in, and beauty preparations are to be given them, and the young woman who pleases the king will be queen instead of Vashti. Excuse me. Now, you notice that the leading qualifications for these young women are A, that they're beautiful, and B, that they please the king. Okay, and that pleasing the king is, again, along the sensual indulgence lines, probably. If you'll remember chapter 1, then you realize that the king hasn't learned his lesson. I mean, Vashti was presumably beautiful, or she wouldn't have been queen. There was no interview about how they would do in submitting to the king or anything like that. And this is consistent with what we saw last week and what you see throughout the Book of Esther. Things are a bit wobbly at the top, okay? And especially among the king's advisors, there tended to be people who tried to steer the king in their own directions, and the king seemed to be willing to go along with them. Again, that's probably not too surprising, but I thought I would mention what the Puritan commentator Trapp says. I think it's a helpful lesson for us. We're commanded to pray for those in authority. But Trapp says the primitive Christian, so referring to those, he's actually referring to a quote from Tertullian, I think, so early church. The primitive Christians prayed hard for the emperor that God would send him a faithful counsel and free him from flatterers. It might be something good for you to remember when you're praying for those in authority over us. And that apparently Ahasuerus suffered from people who didn't always have wisdom or his best interests in mind. Verses 5 through 7, the two main characters of the book, at least from the Jews' point of view, are introduced, Mordecai and Esther. So Mordecai is given a lineage here. He's a Jew. He's the son of Jair, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish, a Benjamite. So that connection with Benjamin and the line of Saul, indirectly, is going to be important for next week when we meet the antagonist. But here, you might say, Mordecai has an impeccable lineage. He, however, has an unattractive Persian name. So Mordecai is his Persian name. We're not ever given his Hebrew name. It's a version of the male deity Marduk, which is the god of Babylon. Okay, now, you know, Daniel and his friends were also given Babylonian names, so maybe it wasn't his idea. But there is, even if you look at this from a literary point of view, you can see the sort of tension that the people are living in. They're Jews, but they're in the midst of a pagan empire. And even their names are given to them as an indication of the dominance they live under. And that's brought out in verse 6. It's not maybe as clear in some translations as in others, but it's the same idea repeated over and over again. Kish had been carried away, so there's the idea of exile, with the captives, there it is again, who had been captured, there it is again, whom the king of Babylon had carried away, there it is again. So in case you missed it, these people are in exile from the promised land. And of course, as I said last week, Mordecai and Esther among those who didn't return to the promised land, who are in some sense away from the central working of God and the reestablishment of the temple. But you see in verse 6, just again from a literary point of view, the emphasis that these folks are in exile. They're captives. They're in a hostile environment. So let me just make a quick comment. In verse 6 in the New King James Version, it says Kish had been carried away from Jerusalem, and then there's a translation footnote that there is actually no name supplied in the original in Hebrew, and I don't know, I didn't check what other translations said. It really just says who had been carried away. The Hebrew, if you just took it in the most natural sense, would probably refer to Mordecai. But if Mordecai had been carried away captive originally, he would be over 100 years old. Okay, now that's possible. It seems more likely that this is referring, as the New King James Version says it, to the last person named in the English translation, Kish. So it's probably not saying that Mordecai actually had been carried away captive from Jerusalem. There is also a reference in Ezra to a Mordecai who returned with Zerubbabel to resettle Jerusalem. And again, some kind of commentators think it's the same Mordecai. He had gone back to resettle, and then for some reason he had returned to Babylon or Persia. Anyway, that's the fellow Mordecai. Okay, I'm not going to, as in several details here, I'm not going to take a definite position there because I think there's not really enough information. That's Mordecai. And the second person who's mentioned is given a Hebrew name, Hadassah, which means myrtle. So myrtle is a very beautiful, has a very beautiful flower, and it's a very beautiful bush or tree. And that would be fitting with Esther, who is a lovely woman. Esther is her Persian name, okay, which again could be from one of the goddesses, or perhaps not, from Ishtar. In any case, Esther is a cousin, we would say a first cousin to Mordecai. Presumably Mordecai is a good bit older because he's been taking care of her. But Esther is an orphan. She had neither father nor mother, and Mordecai is taking care of her. It's easy to, when you remember the story from a distance, to think of Mordecai as her uncle, but he's actually first cousin. And he takes care of her. And there's an emphasis on the care that Mordecai showed toward her. He took her as his own daughter, and you can see that he's very concerned about her. In verse 11, every day Mordecai paced in front of the court of the women's quarters. So whatever you think about Mordecai allowing her to go through this process, Mordecai was very concerned for her. He's commended for her, his love for her. Now, it's at this point when we think of Esther, and we think, again, she also has the dual names, that we should realize that the main point of the story comes through again. Here's a woman who should, on the face of it, be the least likely candidate for the next queen of Persia. She's a Jew, she's an orphan, and she's beautiful, so that would put her in front of the line, but she seems quite unlikely. And Matthew Henry brings forth this point, I guess maybe a sub-theme, maybe not quite the main theme, but one that I mentioned last week. Matthew Henry says, "Who would have thought that a Jewess, a captive and orphan, was born to be a queen, an empress? Yet so it proved. Providence sometimes raiseth up the poor out of the dust to set them among princes," alluding to 1 Samuel 2:8. So that's Esther. Esther is brought up by her cousin because she's an orphan, and she is somehow caught up into this whole process. Now, I mentioned before that probably they just went around and said, "You're coming with me." And in fact, again, if you look at it from a literary point of view, typically the verbs in the account are in the passive. It wasn't like the women all flocked to sign up for this. They were taken. And you can, if you just look through it, you can see again and again, they're brought. They're taken in. So Esther is taken in. She is, the emphasis is given in several places that she was a very beautiful woman. And also that she won the favor of this Haggai, who was in charge of preparing the women. There are extensive preparations. There is some archaeological evidence that they had something like a little tent that they would put over the woman, and they would burn something to perfume her. Doesn't sound very pleasant to me, but it was 6 months with oil of myrrh and 6 months with perfumes and preparations for beautifying women. Okay. This was for the emperor. He wanted only the best, and that's the preparation that was made. Now, the women went in one by one, and it says rather delicately, "In the evening she went, and in the morning she returned to the second house of the women." Now, I'm sure you're aware of the fact that emperors like this often maintained a harem. That's not the word that's used here, but there were lots of women who had been with the king once and were not chosen to be queen. But they went off and lived in this house with all the other women like that, and whenever the king wanted to see them again, he called for them by name and came to be with him. But otherwise, they never were allowed to remarry, they never left the house, they never saw the king again. It wasn't like they could go knock on the door, and that was the way it was. I want you to think of that because, as I said, I'm going to come back to this using the Star Trek analogy. So here you get the sense of the power, and you might say the arbitrary power of the empire. He can use women this way; no one bats an eye. He used men in what might be called worse ways, which I'm not going to go into. But this was simply the way it was. And Mordecai and Esther find themselves in the middle of this situation, and Esther, it turns out, wins the heart of the king. And so it says at the end of the story, verse 17, "The king loved Esther more than all the women, other women. She obtained grace and favor in his sight more than all the virgins. So he set the royal crown upon her head and made her queen instead of Vashti." It's a remarkable turn of events. We'll see a remarkable turn in the other way with Haman, the opponent to the king. But here is a remarkable raising up of a woman who ultimately will act as the deliverer for her people. And that's, in some sense, that's the main point of the story. Chapter 1, the old queen is put down. Chapter 2, God raises up a new queen. In anticipation, I mean, before Haman makes his move, God is already making his moves and preparing her, her and her position for the deliverance of his people. Let me make one other comment, and again, this is sort of along the literary lines. In one of the recent developments in commentaries on the Bible has been to appreciate the literary elements. Sometimes people go overboard, but I think it's helpful to realize this. And so here's a literary motif for people who like to trace this, and that is the feast or banquet. Verse 18, the king made a great feast, the feast of Esther, for all his officials and servants. Chapter 1, what was the context for Vashti's refusal? Well, it was a feast or banquet, actually more than one, and she had one of her own. So we'll see the same thing. Of course, Esther ultimately seeks to deliver her people in the context of providing a meal for the king and Haman, a couple of meals. So that ties the book together, and you see again here the feast that's referred to in verse 18. Let me pause there. I haven't really addressed the questions of whether Mordecai should have let Esther go through this and so on. And I want to come up to this question of assimilation. But let me pause and see if you have any comments or questions so far. Yes?
You mentioned that the king seemed to be easily steered by his advisors. That the advice he got seemed to be very calculated to be the kind of thing he wanted to hear.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. These smart advisors know how to take advantage of the king's inclinations. Yeah.
It's one reason power corrupts.
Yeah, because he can get what he wants. Sure. And he's encouraged to get what he wants.
Oh, that sounds like a good idea.
Yeah. Let's do it. Right. Yeah, that's, again, one of the sort of sub-themes. But it works both ways, right? So Esther can convince the queen, the king, ultimately, of something that that would be something he would like. But it gets worse before it gets better, because Haman plays to the monetary interests of the king. Okay, any other comments or questions? Okay, so I want to think about something of the pressures that were on the people and the way that these pressures are a part of the background of the book of Esther. And I especially think it's helpful because that's one way we can connect with the book of Esther in our own situation, maybe better than some of the Puritans or other earlier commentators could. And I mentioned before I was going to read some comments that interpret this in terms of Star Trek. So I was telling Henry about this last week, and I made the cardinal sin of referring to it as Star Wars. Henry didn't kill me or anything. It's very nice of him. Okay, so that I don't make further technical mistakes, I'm just going to read. This is a commentary on Esther and Ruth. Somehow they always go together. You would think the name would be Duguid, but people who knew him said it's actually Duguid. It's a very helpful series of sermons, actually, on the book of Esther. And he's trying to get at this idea of the control of the empire, the power of the empire, which sounds like, you know, just sort of the jackboot and the military might, but it actually sort of seeps into everything. Their goal is to assimilate all of the people. He says assimilation was the goal of the Persian Empire. Okay, so here's his analogy. In the science fiction series Star Trek The Next Generation, there was a particularly nasty opponent of the Federation called the Borg, who operated by incorporating their enemies into their collective and extracting from them whatever was of value. Their slogan was, "Resistance is futile, you must be assimilated." In just the same way, the Persian Empire sought to assimilate the various peoples that inhabited their territory into a single entity. And he goes on to say, you know, it's difficult because in some sense, the most zealous of the Jews, the ones who would have most resisted the assimilation, were gone, right? Because they went back to Jerusalem. The ones who would have sort of held the line most clearly had already been taken away. And what was left were the people who were maybe comfortable in Babylon and Persia. There may have been various reasons why they stayed behind. So he says, exile had been kind to them. They had come to terms with the powers of the day and had forgotten that the pagan environment in which they lived was always at least potentially hostile and could never be trusted. They had forgotten that the powers that be were fickle masters who could easily turn against them. And then he makes a very insightful point in connection with this. If assimilation was one temptation that faced the people of Esther's day, then despair was surely another. They were surrounded by a fickle, all-powerful empire that might well turn out to be antagonistic, and they followed a God whose ways were often inscrutable, invisible, and mysterious. What then could keep them from despair? As the Borg realized, despair and assimilation are closely related. The reason they constantly repeated the resistance is futile slogan is that those who have given up hope are easily assimilated. How then could the Jewish exiles hold on to hope and faithfulness in the midst of a hostile pagan environment? So I think that's a very helpful insight. And again, I think it helps us to relate to the book maybe better than some of the commentators of earlier generations who tend just to register positive or negative declarations on what Mordecai and Esther have done. And I will try to come back to that. But we should look at them and the struggle they had and realize that that's exactly the same sort of struggle we face. You know, at the beginning when I was talking about the serpent and seeking to stamp out the seed of the woman and the persecution against the church, I used the example of persecution. Okay? But Satan has other ways, right, of corrupting the church. The quote from the Westminster Confession talked about a church that worshiped God according to his will, not just any bunch of people that have the name of Christian. And you know, right, there are lots of groups that have the name of Christian but are sadly too well assimilated. And you also know that I think we all face the same pressure of assimilation. Just get along in the society. Don't try to stand up and assert anything that's distinctively of Christ. And so that temptation to assimilation is one of Satan's subtle means. And the temptation to despair is one of Satan's subtle means. And the book of Esther can encourage us to see that God preserves us from despair by showing us that he will fulfill his promise. He not only delivered the Jews from the destruction that Haman sought, but he preserved a line of faithful Jews till the coming of the Messiah and continues to preserve a witness for his name. So that, as I said, is I think a helpful connection for us with the book, but let me say a little bit about the question about Mordecai and Esther. Okay, so if you read commentators, you will see quite divergent opinions about what Mordecai and Esther did. If you read especially the Puritan commentators and actually many of the other older Christian commentators, they tend to defend Mordecai and Esther. Okay? Mordecai had some reason for telling Esther that she shouldn't reveal her people. Okay? Normally, you know, you would think that it would be a good thing to say that you're a Jew. Daniel didn't hide that from people. It would have made it easier for Esther to keep the kosher laws. I mean, how do you keep a kosher law in preparation to see the king or after your queen when you never told anyone that you're a Jew? But the Puritan commentators tended to say Mordecai must have had some special revelation or some reason. Maybe Esther would have said she was a Jew if they had asked her, but you know, if no one asked her, then she doesn't volunteer that information. And there is a way you can make that argument, I think. Of course, there are other questions about simply how you could allow the person you're the guardian of to go through this process. Okay? And I think the basic answer is probably a pretty good one. And that is, they didn't really have a choice in the matter. There was one medieval Jewish commentator who said that Mordecai should have done all he could to prevent it, and in the end, he should have killed Esther rather than let her go through that. Now, that sounds rather harsh, but remember the law forbade marrying a non-Jew. And actually, this was exactly the trouble that was going on back in Jerusalem at exactly this time. You read Ezra and Nehemiah, so not exactly contemporaneous. But they had problems with intermarriage. And here we are, the queen of the empire is a Jew. Okay, so that's the sort of tension that that medieval Jewish writer probably would have sensed. And I'm reluctant to give my own judgments. The contemporary writers, especially, I think both Jewish and Christian, tend to say that there's a huge amount of moral ambiguity here. Mordecai and Esther did the best they could in the situation. There is a way of reading the account which said that Esther sort of did more than she needed to win the queen's favor. Like, she was really zealous to be queen. I'm not completely convinced. It seems that Esther, whether she made good choices or bad choices, didn't have a wide range of options. Okay? Sorry, that's not a completely satisfactory explanation. As I said, I don't really think that's the question that the account wants us to raise, except for us to realize that they were under pressure to be assimilated, and it encourages us to realize that we face quite similar pressures. As this commentator Duguid says, you probably wouldn't at this point in the story sing the song "Dare to Be an Esther." I don't know if I never sang the song "Dare to Be a Daniel." Sorry, in the Methodist Church we didn't have that one in our hymnal. Maybe you guys know it.
Oh, I assumed that was
VeggieTales. Now there actually is a hymn, and I looked it up on the internet. It's like a legitimate hymn. At this point, you probably wouldn't commend Esther to your daughters as a role model. Now later on, it takes a lot of courage to do what she did. At this point, I would say there's a fair amount of moral ambiguity. Esther had to figure out how to survive. I don't really think it's helpful to make absolute moral judgments either way, but if you want to argue with me in the Q&A time, that's okay. I really think if we focus on that, then we're going to miss the point of the book, which is that with faithful people and sometimes against faithful people, God accomplished his purposes. Yeah. Ultimately, God turn the story around on the sleepless night of the king, as I said before. So surely he could use a faithful servant or even an unfaithful servant. Since you mentioned VeggieTales, by the way, I should have said last week, so there's a relatively recent movie on Esther, and there's also a VeggieTales on Esther. And I haven't seen either one. It's especially embarrassing that I haven't seen the VeggieTales one, because I should, for cultural literacy, I should know the VeggieTales one. But I haven't seen either one. I did read summaries of them on the internet, but I'm none the wiser for the moral ambiguity part. Someone else might fill me in. Any comments or questions?
So what do the modern commentators say about this issue of Mordecai advising Esther this? Modern in the sense of 20th century.
Yeah, you mean about what to do about her heritage? Or, it's interesting. So there's one survey of the Old Testament. I can tell you afterward who the commentator is. It's rather ironic. But he tries to make the point at the beginning of his survey that we shouldn't draw all these moralistic conclusions, that the Old Testament is telling a story, so we shouldn't look for it. And then he says, Mordecai sinned by telling Esther not to reveal her company. That's really the main point on which the story turns, his sin. And when he later repented of his sin, then God delivered his people. Because they were appointed to be a witness to the nations. And by silencing her, he frustrated that aspect of the witness. Okay? Now that there is an important point there. But I would say most commentators basically saying Mordecai was trying to have them both keep their heads low. Because you never knew what was going to happen. Haman in the next chapter is anti-Semitic. Maybe he had wind of there was a lot of anti-Semitism around, and you just need to keep quiet. So I would say that's what most contemporary commentators that I've read say. This is the pressure of assimilation. These are not terribly satisfactory answers, but then again, I would say that that's not... The writer doesn't address them because he doesn't really want us to focus on that aspect, except for the sort of sub-theme of assimilation. Anyway, does that answer your question?
Yep.
Any other comments or questions? Yes.
This whole moralism question always seems to be very hard when you take an extreme situation.
Right.
And then try to say, but did they do the right thing or not?
Yeah. Yeah. I think often the Bible doesn't really give us enough information, and the situation is unusual enough. Dare to be a Daniel. Well, wherever you are, you need to, according to your calling, you need to be obedient to God. But most of us are not in the situation Daniel was in.
Or Esther.
Or Esther. So you have to figure out how to do it, and that's what the rest of the Bible is helpful for. And I think that's an important point. This book is written without that whole context, obviously Revelation, but Revelation 12. But without bringing up again the Abrahamic promise, the Abrahamic covenant, and it is difficult. On the other end, in 1 Corinthians 10, Paul says these things were written for our examples. He's talking about the Israelites. So. In some sense, we have to learn from what happened. It's just it's a little difficult, and you have to be careful in doing it. Okay. Well, next week we get to meet Haman, and we can hiss, or as the Jews would do, stamp our feet when we read his name. Anyway, I'll talk about that next week.
Okay.
Let's close prayer.